watches. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, Free Radio Asheville, WZKW Kingsville, WRFN Nashville, KRBS Oroville, The Surge 96.3, Radio Veronica.us, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, or WMRW Warren. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. This week on the program, we'll present a forum held last week in Washington, D.C. on the impeachment of the Bush administration. You will hear a discussion that should have been, but was not, taking place on the floor of Congress. You will hear a forum that should have been aired on every major media outlet, but was not. The moderator was lawyer Kevin Zeese, an independent candidate for Senate and a lead activist with the D.C.-based peace group Democracy Rising, democracyrising.us, which he founded with Ralph Nader and Virginia Rodino. Panelists were Marcus Raskin of the Institute for Policy Studies, former diplomat Anne Wright, former Attorney General Ramsey Clark, David Swanson of AfterDowningStreet.org, and Cindy Sheehan of Gold Star Families for Peace. In addition to the legal issues that you will hear raised by panelists and questioners, the most important part, in my view, for citizens such as ourselves, was the moral imperative raised by panelists, that we have an obligation to stop a government and power structure which is making war on the world for the purpose of looting it. Ironically, it was our nation's entry into World War II that tipped the balance against Hitler and liberated the concentration camps. In this present situation, we can expect no rescue from the outside, and we are, as a people, complicit with the crimes of our government if we do not stop them, whether or not we are personally suffering from this regime. I mention this because many people in Germany lived quite normally and even saw improvements in their personal situation under fascism. Such people, even if they were bakers or plumbers, were deemed in the discourse of the war crimes, trials, and principles laid down at Nuremberg to have failed in their obligations to oppose the conduct of their government. The U.S. Constitution provides a remedy: impeachment. We begin with moderator Kevin Zeese of Democracy Rising.
Start with the impeachment generally, and then the panelists will get more specific. On May 31st last year, Ralph Nader and I wrote a column in the Boston Globe, and we said that based on the mountains of fabrications, deceptions, and lies, it's time to debate the I word, impeachment. Today I would change that, and I would say the president and vice president have so systematically abused the powers of their offices with such impunity, and they have clearly violated the rule of law, that now they must be removed from office. At this time of never-ending war in our futures, it's particularly important to make sure that the president and vice president do not become monarchs, and that they understand they have to live within the law, they have to obey the law, and they are subject to the law. There are several impeachable offenses that you'll hear talked about in detail. Let me just briefly go through some of them, and then the speakers will add to it. First, the illegal war. A law violates our domestic law when there's no congressional declaration of war, and there has been no congressional declaration of war. A law violates our laws when it violates international treaties like the UN Charter. This law violates that treaty. When a war is illegal, then every act committed in name of that war, every person killed and injured, Iraqi and U.S., every building destroyed, is a war crime. And that's what we're seeing every day in Iraq, is war crime after war crime. The conduct of the war in violation of international treaty obligations under the UN Charter as we've conducted this war and the Geneva Conventions as we've conducted this war further violates our own domestic law because these are treaties that we have agreed to. And once we've agreed to a treaty, they become the law of the land. The torture scandals and the violation of U.S. criminal laws at the highest levels of our government, with the trail back to the president and the vice president, with President Bush saying that to the country the U.S. does not participate in torture. When we've seen the pictures of torture, when we read the stories about Guantanamo Bay, when we've read the stories about detainees and people in our custody being sent to countries to be tortured, we know our country tortures, and our president is lying to us once again. Do we believe President Bush, or do we believe our lying eyes? I think we believe our lying eyes. Why impeachment? Impeachment because the Constitution and the Congress require it. And I think it's become especially clear with the most recent allegations regarding the violation of the FISA Act, the warrantless searching of listening to eavesdropping on telephone conversations for the last 4 years of hundreds, maybe thousands of Americans. And the Impeachment Act in the Constitution, Article 3, Section 4, says the president, the vice president, and all civil officers of the United States shall be removed from office for on impeachment for and conviction of treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors. A high crime and misdemeanor essentially is a serious abuse of power. It doesn't have to be a crime. In this case, the FISA Act violation, by the way, is a 5-year felony. So there are crimes in this case. Manipulation of intelligence is also a crime under U.S. law. So there are crimes here. While impeachment, of course, should not be pursued lightly, it is something that should be pursued. Congress needs to reassert itself as an equal branch of government. There is a balance of powers. There is a balance of powers that is out of balance that needs to be reasserted. The president and vice president are justifying their impeachable acts by claiming it's a time of war. It's a war that can last for our whole lives, for generations. It's particularly important to know that the Constitution does not change in a time of war. The Congress does not lose its power as an equal branch of government in a time of war. The Bill of Rights does not disappear in a time of war. And President Bush and Dick Cheney need to be told that, and told that clearly by the U.S. Congress. Let me move on now to our first speaker, Marcus Raskin. Marcus is the founder of the Institute for Policy Studies. It's the oldest and most effective, truly progressive think tank in Washington, D.C. Prior to founding IPS, Mark was a member of the special staff of the National Security Council in President Kennedy's administration. He's also served as a member of the Presidential Commission on Education and an advisor to the Bureau of Budget and the Office of Science and Technology in the Executive Office of the President. He's currently serving as a professor at George Washington University. He's also written extensively on the President and the web exclusive called Presidential Disrespect. And he has a current book that just came out, In Democracy's Shadow, The Secret World of National Security, which I'd urge you to pick up. A special note for this event, Marcus was actually prosecuted by the gentleman to my right during the Vietnam War era, along with his co-conspirators. Marcus, this is an anti-war protest case. And I'll say that the key point, Marcus is a leader of progressive thought in Washington, D.C., and he'll be speaking for himself today as an individual. Marcus Raskin.
Thank you very much. Let me take us back a little bit, and you'll pardon me for looking at this a little bit historically. Coming out of the First World War, there was a very great concern that war was a mistake, and that it shouldn't have been fought, and that the Western powers should not have been at war with each other. The United States pressed very hard for a treaty called the Kellogg-Briand Pact. Now, the Kellogg-Briand Pact said that no nation should make aggressive war against another nation. And this was adopted as part of the law of the United States. Furthermore, it was signed by other nations, including Germany. And the importance of this is that after the Second World War, what happened was it was clear that something had to be done. And so the next step, trying to change international law and domestic law, was to have a statement, a true statement, that would make clear that war crimes indeed could not be tolerated by the people of the world. In that regard, the United States pressed very hard for the Nuremberg trials. And the position that was taken by the United States through Justice Jackson, who at that time left, for time being, the Supreme Court to go argue the case for the United States, said that the biggest war crime of all is war, and that in the context of war, there were many different war crimes. But furthermore, the greatest crime was that of aggressive war, where in effect, one nation undertook by election to decide whether or not it would go to war against another without any sort of proper reason to do so. Furthermore, under the United Nations Charter, it was clear that you couldn't do this anymore. There were specific actions that had to be taken by a nation before it went to war. Now, the reality is that during the Cold War, the United States had a policy of preemptive war. Preemption in that context meant that when it appeared that a nuclear strike would occur on the United States, there could be a preemptive strike. On the other hand, there was no statement for preventive war. The changes that have occurred over the course of this last year and a half, or 2 years, with the President Bush and his administration, is not just preemptive war, it's preventive aggressive war. And aggressive and preventive war is very clearly, under Nuremberg, a war crime. Now, how did it come to this? You know, how did it come to this situation? Well, first of all, at the end of the Cold War, certain people within the government and outside decided that the United States was a single superpower. And because it was, similar to an 800-pound elephant, it could come and go and sit where it wanted. And that there was no reason not to do so because military power was the basic coin of the realm and nuclear weapons were the coin of the realm. With this in mind, the United States, with the Bush administration, went ahead and prepared an aggressive war against Iraq. It did so for several reasons, and those reasons are peculiar in some way, and they add up together to not very much, but they're there. One was as a military exercise to test out the idea of shock and awe, or what the Germans called in the 1930s the Blitzkrieg idea of war. This was going to be the new kind of war which was to be fought. Secondly, the United States had an interest in being sure that the lifestyle of the United States would be protected, and in order to do that, it had to have a handle on future oil reserves. Third, it undertook to test out new ideas of propaganda and new ideas of how it was able to indeed utilize and fool, if you will, the bureaucracy itself through the idea that there were weapons of mass destruction. And you will recall that this came down to the President of the United States looking for weapons of mass destruction at the National Press Club, and everybody getting a very good laugh about it. Well, there was nothing really to laugh about, because the result of his game, of this propaganda, was that hundreds of thousands of people died. So that he was involved, engaged in a self-deception. Now, it's not only a self-deception against a bureaucracy and a use of the bureaucracy for his own purposes, for aggressive war, but it's also a use of Congress. And we've already heard how the Constitution is undercut by a deceptive position taken by the President of the United States to Congress, and where what is presented to the Congress itself turns out to be incorrect information, information that itself is tailored, wherein no basic judgments can be made that would allow for real intelligence of the national community to be able to be made. So that's another thing that occurred. So Congress itself was turned into the Supreme Soviet by this president. This is a problem, mind you, which has been there for 45 years or 50 years, that did not begin with Bush, too. But on the other hand, he has taken this to a new level, and he has operated on the basis of leadership by whim. The result of this is seen every day in terms of a war without end. And the meaning of a war without end is basically that the Constitution is suspended, that instead what is taken over is all sorts of ideas of security. But then the question becomes, who is being made secure? Well, it's not clear that the United States is, in terms of having to fight two wars around the world simultaneously, and as well seeing our good name put through the mud by this administration. So that's not making us feel more secure. And surely it's not making more secure citizens of the United States who find themselves informed upon, who find that the nation itself is being turned into spies and the spied upon. And this situation creates, again, a problem in the society of enormous insecurity, fear, and anxiety. Now, the fact of the matter is that there are real problems in the world. What we have done is gone exactly in the reverse way to deal with those problems, that like a neurotic, we're making those problems worse by not being willing to deal with the fundamentals of what's going on. Two last points. The United States operated over a 45 to 50 year period fairly well, being what we would call, or what I would call, prudent imperialists. And that was basically a position taken by the Democratic Party, the establishment of the United States. It worked well, except in the case of the Indochina War, where it fell to pieces. But it still was within certain confines and boundaries. What we have now is nationalist triumphalism. And with nationalist triumphalism, the idea is that the president has the power and his clique has the power to do what it is that it wants to do. So are there remedies? Yes, there are, and they're found in the Constitution. And that's where we are at this point. We don't have to talk about corruption. We don't have to talk about all of that. But what we do need to understand is that we are at a crossroads, and that crossroads is that we must now restore the branch of government, Congress. It has to get out of its own supine situation. It also means that there has to be a way of finding out what in fact is going on. We cannot make critical, intelligent judgments as citizens without finding out what is going on. And the finding out now requires a congressional investigation of the facts of the case. Those facts will, in my view, take us very far along the road to both impeachment and then presentation in the Senate for possible conviction. One reason that we feel strongly, that I feel strongly about this, is that unless we do something now, this issue of war without end, of executive power, is going to haunt everybody over the course of the 21st century in this country. And it could turn out to be a terrible, terrible disaster for the American people. Thank you.
We're gonna take some questions now for Marcus.
I have a question. Given these arguments, what could be the legal arguments they would use against impeachment?
One argument that would be used is that the president in time of war has virtually full executive power to do pretty much as he wants. Now, that would be one argument that would be used. The second is they would say that Congress, in fact, gave authorizing power in both cases. That is the case of going to war in a resolution, and also supposedly he has the power under the Homeland Security Act. My view of the reading of all this is that that's false, that neither of this is the case. They will attempt to make this argument, and in my view, it will fall to the ground.
Historically, because I don't remember an op-ed piece that Mr. Raskin published in the pages of the New York Times, I believe in 1974, where he called for the military to intervene to replace Richard Nixon, who at that time was under siege in the twilight of the Watergate scandals, openly called for the military to intervene. I think you remember that. I wonder if you could comment on that now and on the prospect of the fact that these criminals and gangsters, thugs as I regard them, I believe they engineered 9/11. I don't expect everybody here to agree with that. The notion that these people would then quietly retire and percolate out into the private corporate sector and the various private intelligence agencies and mercenary operations that we've now become familiar with doesn't exactly fill me with assurance and confidence. I would never feel safe in terms of the public safety of this country until these people were arrested and indicted for murder of American citizens right here on American soil, and especially their collaborators in the media who've really perpetrated some monstrous hoaxes on the American people and effectively brainwashed the American public. I wish you'd reference that op-ed piece that you penned very articulately back there in 1974, Professor Raskin. Thank you.
Well, I don't think I wrote it. I did have several pieces in the New York Times, but not along those lines. I can assure you I am not in favor of military coup d'etats. And so I would put that aside. I would be eager to see your reference to that and send it to me, and I certainly will go back and look. There is no way I would have said something like that, so far as I can tell.
Okay. Let's move on to our next speaker, who is Anne Wright. Let me introduce her. Anne served for 29 years in the Army and Army Reserve, 16 years as a high-ranking Foreign Service officer in the State Department. In the Army, she served primarily in special operation units and attained the rank of colonel. Ms. Wright joined the Foreign Service in 1987, serving as the Deputy Chief of Mission at U.S. embassies in Sierra Leone, Micronesia, Mongolia, and Afghanistan. She received the State Department's highest award for heroism for her actions during the evacuation of 2,500 personnel from the Civil War in Sierra Leone, the largest evacuation the State Department's had to do since the Vietnam War in 1974 in Saigon. Ms. Wright was also on the first State Department team to go to Kabul, Afghanistan, to reopen the embassy in December 2001. Ms. Wright resigned from the Foreign Service on March 19, 2003, due to her disagreement with President Bush, his decision to go to war in Iraq without authorization of the UN Security Council. as well as her concerns about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, which is not being resolved, and the policy toward North Korea, and the unnecessary curtailment of civil liberties in the United States. Ms. Wright has a master's in law degree from the University of Arkansas and a master's degree in national security affairs from the U.S. Naval College, Newport, Rhode Island. Please welcome Ms. Ann Wright.
Thank you very much, Kevin. It's a pleasure to be here and to be on this panel. And all I can say is we, the people, want some accountability. We want some accountability in what's going on here. And that accountability can take many forms. And one form we're talking about today, which I totally think we need to be pushing as the people of America, is this thing called impeachment. I mean, when you have a president of the United States that flouts international law, when indeed he commits the country to a war of aggression that is outlawed, we the people have to stand up. We the people have to take our country back. We've got examples of people, not just me, resigning from the diplomatic corps about what was going on, that indeed this war didn't follow any of the criteria that you're supposed to have for a just war, getting the Security Council to agree to it, or this being something that is so vital to your national security that indeed you have to have a strike right then. We didn't have any of that. We didn't have a humanitarian disaster that was going on. It didn't meet any of the criteria for a just war. Indeed, it was a crime of aggression. And indeed, a colleague from the UK, the Deputy Legal Counsel of the UK, also resigned in March of 2003, the same time I did, Elizabeth Willemshurst. And in her letter of resignation, she, the Deputy Legal Counsel of the Foreign and Commonwealth Office of the UK, said, going to war under the circumstances that have been outlined by the U.S. to the U.K. would be a war of aggression, a war crime. She was right on the money, and 10-1, when we find the documents from our own government, 10-1, our legal counsels of our major bureaus, our major departments, were probably telling our president the same thing. These are documents that haven't surfaced yet, but give them time, because they're out there. We know they're out there. It's the accountability of taking a country to war, the accountability of, if you are in a war, even if it's just, how you conduct that war. And indeed, the shock and awe that Marcus was talking about, shock and awe, gratuitous, unnecessary levels of violence that cause incredible harm to innocent civilians. These are violations of the law of land warfare, the Geneva Conventions that we, the United States, have signed on to. This administration has committed the war of aggression. It's committed violations of the Geneva Convention. It's committed violations in torture. That's the one that we get the pictures in our faces. We, the United States, under this administration, are torturing people in violation of international law, in violation of our own domestic law. If you look at really what's going on right now, who's been held accountable for anything? Nobody. Zipola. I mean, you have seven low-ranking Army reservists that have been held accountable for some of the abuses of Abu Ghraib, and they certainly should be held accountable. You have one former brigadier general reduced in rank to colonel, Janice Karpinski. She should be held accountable. You've got a lot of other people out there. Major General Miller, no accountability. He takes the Fifth Amendment when he's asked to testify before a court-martial. You've got Lieutenant General Sanchez that orders that control of a certain sector of Abu Ghraib prison goes from the military police to the military intelligence, and 2 weeks later, you have atrocities start being committed in that prison. There are lots of people that need to be held accountable. We have a chief warrant officer who was court-martialed just a couple of weeks ago. He was convicted of negligent homicide for stuffing an Iraqi general inside a sleeping bag and then suffocating him, sitting on his back and suffocating him. He was convicted of negligent manslaughter, and his peers in the U.S. Army have let him off. There is no accountability going on here. and our country is suffering. Our military, the military I served 29 years, is getting unbelievably broken. It's being broken physically. It's being broken morally. We have a responsibility as people of the country to hold our Congress accountable and the executive accountable. If we don't hold the Congress accountable and force them to first have a commission of inquiry followed by articles of impeachment, if warranted, and I certainly think they will be warranted, then we are just as complicit as the guy that said, we're going to war in Iraq and we are just going to go. So we, the people, have to force this. And it's happening. There are commissions, just as Ray McGovern said just a minute ago. Last week, a commission in New York City, over 1,000 people attended a two-day conference. There are conferences that have been held in California. They've been held in Istanbul. They're being held all over the country, all over the world, because everybody in the world knows what this administration has done. So you, the people in this room, it's up to you. It's up to you to go to your neighbors. It's up to your neighbors to go to their relatives. All over the country, we have to get out on the streets to get our Congress moving. We have an election coming up. We've got to get people in there. And one of the criteria for voting for a person would be, will you support, will you submit articles of impeachment against this administration?
Our next speaker, David Swanson, is someone I work with at democracyrising.us quite regularly, and he wears many hats as an incredibly productive advocate for ending the Iraq war and for the impeachment of President Bush and Vice President Cheney. He is co-founder of the AfterDowningStreet.org. After Downing Street was a coalition we formed to bring out the Downing Street memos that were not being covered by the corporate media. He's also a co-founder of the Impeachment PAC, an organization trying to support candidates who favor impeachment, and he's supporter of the Citizens Impeachment Commission. He's been working with major polling firms to monitor the views of Americans on impeachment. He'll report on that. Prior to his activism, he's also a newspaper reporter, and he serves on the Executive Council of the Washington and Baltimore Newspaper Guild, and he serves as communication director for many various functions, including as the press secretary for Dennis Kucinich in 2004. Please welcome David Swanson.
On March 18th, 2003, the day before Ann Wright resigned, President Bush, as required by Congress in its resolution authorizing the use of force, sent Congress a formal statement of why a war on Iraq was immediately necessary. He sent a one-page letter and a nine-page report. The letter used the language that Congress had provided and asserted that Iraq posed a threat and constituted a terrorist organization. The report said that Iraq was harboring and aiding terrorists and terrorist organizations that threatened the U.S., and that a war on Iraq was a vital part of a war on terrorism. It said that Iraq possessed chemical and biological weapons, and that it was developing nuclear weapons, and that Iraq was a threat to the U.S. because of its long-range missiles and its unmanned aerial vehicles, and because it could share weapons of mass destruction with terrorist groups that it was supposedly harboring, including Al-Qaeda. These and other statements in that report and in other communications to Congress and to the public through the media were intentional lies, and it is a felony to lie to Congress. Taking a nation to war on the basis of lies is not just a high crime, it is the highest crime possible. When we spoke yesterday in Los Angeles, there was a young man, a soldier who'd fought in Iraq, who spoke with us and got up and talked about what had been done to him and what post-traumatic stress disorder was like and what it felt like to be completely discarded by the United States military when they were done with him. And he broke into tears. And, you know, 30% of the troops coming back have serious mental problems. There was there was a woman who spoke as well, who, like Cindy Sheehan, lost her son in this war. And we went out to the beach in Santa Monica, and we looked at the crosses representing every single U.S. soldier who has died in Iraq. And there was a little sign in the corner that said, if we were to display the Iraqis killed, it would fill the entire beach. So this is the kind of impact we're talking about. This is why this is the highest crime possible. So if this is not an instance to start talking about impeachment, there never can be one. On July 20th, 2002, the CIA and MI6, that's the secret intelligence of this country and of the United Kingdom, had an all-day meeting across the river at CIA headquarters. And Sir Richard Dearlove had a 90-minute private meeting with George Tenet, the head of the CIA. Dearlove is the head of MI6. 3 days later in London, Dearlove reported on his CIA meeting at number 10 Downing Street, the office and residence of Prime Minister Tony Blair. This was a meeting with Tony Blair and with his foreign secretary, his defense secretary, his attorney general, the chairman of Joint Intelligence Committee, the chief of defense staff, a foreign policy advisor, and a foreign policy aide who took the minutes, which came to be called the Downing Street Minutes or the Downing Street Memo. And this memo, together with seven related leaked documents, makes crystal clear that Bush and Cheney had decided to go to war long before admitting it to Congress or the American people, that Bush and Cheney had decided to lie about weapons of mass destruction and ties to terrorism, that the Brits were concerned about the illegality of an aggressive war, but the Bush administration really was not, that going to the UN was an attempt to legalize a war that had been decided upon long before and not in any sense an attempt to avoid a war. The hope was of getting Saddam Hussein to reject an ultimatum on inspections. The language used in the memos was to wrong foot Saddam, and it was made very, very clear that this was the goal. It didn't work. He accepted the terms, but, you know, we got a war anyway. The other thing that's made clear in these documents is that the focus of the Bush and Blair administrations was entirely on persuading the public and not at all on what it was telling the public they were up to, that is, trying to avoid a war. And it's made very clear that the Bush administration and the Blair administration were aware that Iraq was not a threat, even to its neighbors. The Downing Street documents are backed up by numerous U.S. sources. We haven't had the kind of leaks we need, as Ann rightly keeps pushing for, but we've had quite a few. We know from independent reporting that Bush wanted a war with Iraq for regime change before he took office. We know from Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill that Bush was planning a war for regime change in January 01. We know that in March 02, Bush was reported as saying, F blank 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 Saddam, we're taking him out. We know from Secretary of War Donald Rumsfeld that he was planning an attack just hours after the airplanes hit on September 11th. We know from Richard Clark that Bush told him on September 12th to find reasons to attack Iraq. We know from Senator Trent Lott that the Bush administration was focused on regime change in Iraq shortly after 9/11. On September 20th, Undersecretary of Defense Doug Faith wrote a memo advocating attacking Iraq, which he referred to as, quote, deliberately selecting a non-Al-Qaeda target. So the White House Iraq group was formed to market this war to us, the American people, to leak phony evidence to the New York Times and to hit all the talk shows the same morning to talk about what had shown up in the New York Times, which it was then possible to talk about. These were leaks of classified information, although you don't hear any protests from the White House about these leaks, about the aluminum tubes and so forth. There doesn't seem to be an issue there. The White House pressured intelligence officials, and Ray McGovern, who's sitting in the back of the room, can tell you about this story, but the White House pressured intelligence officials to get with the program and punished those who told the truth. And Colin Powell went to the United Nations and rattled off a string of lies that his own staff at the State Department had told him would not even be plausible. This was a show for U.S. media outlets, not for the United Nations. So the evidence is extensive that each claim for each specific weapons program and for the ties to 11 was known at the time to be a lie. And a majority of the American public in polls say that they know that Bush lied. A majority also say, and this is not well enough known, that they favor impeachment for those lies. And a majority in Pennsylvania, which is the only state where this has been asked, favor voting for congressional candidates who want impeachment. And that's a majority of Pennsylvanians. If you look at Democrats in Pennsylvania, it's 85%, right? So the question arises, does the Democratic Party want to continue to exist, or does it want to ignore what 85% of its supporters want and 75% of them want very strongly? So there are exceptions. There are Democrats in Congress who are listening to what the public wants. One of them is Congressman John Conyers. And one of the members of his excellent staff is going to be here later this afternoon. We're going to have a meeting after this meeting that I'll tell you about in a second. But when I mentioned Congressman Conyers in L.A., the shout arose, Conyers for president. And he deserves that because he has introduced a bill, House Resolution 635, H-Res 635, that would create an investigation to make recommendations on impeachment. This is the first step that was taken for Clinton and for Nixon. This is one of the ways you get to impeachment. And if your Congress member has not signed on to co-sponsor, you need to have a serious talk with them. One of the other ways that you can get to impeachment is for a Congress member to cut to the chase and introduce articles of impeachment. And there is no reason that any member of Congress should not be doing that. It was recently discovered that there's another way you can get to impeachment. A state legislature, without a governor, without a Congress member, can send charges of impeachment to the House of Representatives, and that includes occupied territories, not just states. So the Washington, D.C. Washington, D.C. can take the lead, and we are going to have a meeting as soon as this meeting is over for anyone who wants to stay, and we're going to talk about putting together a committee to both pressure Eleanor Holmes Norton to introduce articles of impeachment and to lobby the D.C. City Council to do what it has to do. And it's a race. They're working on this in California. Ann's going to be talking to Hawaii. We'll see which member of Congress wants to become an instant international hero or which state wants to do it. So before I stop talking, I just want to mention a couple of organizations. One is impeachpack.org. We asked people to give us money to support candidates for Congress who promised to make their first act in office impeaching Bush and Cheney. We very quickly raised $50,000. If you want to give us some more, we're not going to turn it away. And we're looking at a dozen candidates who say that they are for this position. And we've endorsed one already, Tony Truppiano from the 11th District of Michigan, who is going to be in Congress in 2007. The other organization, which you'll also find at impeachpack.org, is the Citizens Impeachment Commission, which a number of people at this table sit on, and which includes many prominent legal scholars, historians, activists, journalists, and we are going to be pushing this issue into the media and therefore into Congress. And with that, I'll turn it back to Kevin.
You can see all the Downing Street memos at either afterdowningstreet.org or at democracyrising.us. Ramsey Clark is a lawyer and human rights activist. He's well known as the Attorney General under the Lyndon Johnson administration, the 66th Attorney General of the United States. He's the recipient of the Gandhi Peace Prize, which is given each year by the government of India. He's also active with ImpeachBush.org, which I hope people will support. They're the ones who are doing this advertising campaign behind him that's been appearing in major media around the country. Let me just say something about the work he's doing now regarding Saddam Hussein, which is controversial to a lot of people, but I think people who understand the law recognize the very important work that he's doing in standing up in a very difficult situation representing or helping to represent Mr. Hussein. Ramsey Clark is well known as a human rights advocate, and for him to be in that trial brings a national spotlight, an international spotlight to it that helps to ensure a fair trial. And that's very important because for this kind of a trial of a high-profile former leader like Mr. Saddam Hussein, it's critical to have people like Mr. Clark bring attention to it to ensure a fair trial, because if it's an unfair trial, if it's a kangaroo court, then it has a reverse effect. Instead of being a closure for the country and moving on, it becomes an open wound that makes things worse. And sadly, the way we're seeing the Saddam Hussein trial play out, it looks like it's going to make things worse with the pressuring of judges, with three judges resigning, with defense attorneys assassinated. I think, unfortunately, the United States is making things worse rather than better with this trial. But I think Mr. Clark's role in it is an act of ethics. It's an act of brave leadership. And I really appreciate him for it. As someone who's trained in the criminal law like myself, who's practiced criminal law, I understand the challenge of staying next to people who are unpopular in the world, and I really appreciate Mr. Clark for doing what he's doing with Saddam Hussein. With that, Ramsey Clark.
Thank you very much. I don't think it'll seem alarmist to this crowd, but we may have to make it seem real to the rest of the country. President Bush and his vice president and his key officials are the greatest threat to peace, to human rights, to economic justice worldwide, the genocide of poverty, the greatest genocide, as Gandhi called it, to the environment, and global warming doesn't exist in his philosophy, if you want to dignify it by that word, to the Constitution of the United States. They're the greatest threat to the rule of law that the American people and the world at large face today. If they've got a competitor, tell me who it is. For any of those threats to the survival of life on the planet. For that reason, impeachment is the most important obligation of the citizens of the United States at this moment. Impeachment this year. It's a congressional, it's a House of Representatives election year. Every member, 435, will be up. It's one of those rare times when the people themselves can exert some small influence, perhaps, if they'll pull up their socks and get out there and do it. Because we're in deep trouble. If we can't recapture the Constitution, if we can't insist upon the war-making power, awful as it is, being restored to its proper custodian, if we can't insist upon the Bill of Rights and become a nation that seeks the human dignity of every man, woman, and child on earth, God help those people that have no choice but to bear the burden of our violence. It's deeply ingrained. We spend more on war than all other countries combined. The real measure of a change in U.S. policy is when we begin to reduce the military budget radically. And it's not a partisan matter, sadly. We ought to recall Madeleine Albright turning to Colin Powell and saying, when she wanted a little war, what's the point of having all those weapons if you don't use them? And that's exactly the way it works. when we think of how our country is being presented to the world as glorifying, not just justifying, but glorifying torture. Memos from the president's legal counsel, from the attorney general and others saying, well, a little torture is essential to having our way. Do we really think that we have a greater threat than the United States faced in the Revolutionary War and the Indian Wars before that, and the War of 1812 and the Civil War, that we have to throw away all the rights that have protected the energies and the imaginations of our people, that have enabled us to build this wild, materialistic society that we now have? The only way we can regain respect and trust, and maybe a small measure of affection from the people around the world who watch what we've done not only in Iraq but in so many other places. I mean, we never think of Haiti. The New York Times, if you saw it yesterday, reminded of us with about a 3-page spread. George Bush said Aristide has to go. For God's sake, he wasn't even elected. But Aristide had 60% of the population voting for him. I mean, the population, not the voting age population. He was one of the few politicians in the country, a priest, who had a vow of poverty and knew how the Haitian people lived. It was trusted by the people. We overthrew him, and Haiti, which is the poorest country in the hemisphere, has plummeted. There are bodies on the street every morning. 2 years after Bush had our plane, our U.S. Air Force plane, force Aristide out of the country, away from the country. They're still demanding for him to return. He's the leader they want. The government we tried to install is dysfunctional, just like the court and government we tried to install and are our surrogates. I mean, how come all those people that are prominent in Iraq today were exiles during the long period of the 80s and the 90s? And so many on the payroll of the CIA, even engaging as Ayad Alawi, our first surrogate prime minister there, in terrorist acts against theaters and schools in Iraq during the 90s for the CIA. You think the people don't know that? To go to Iraq today is absolutely heartbreaking, absolutely heartbreaking. It's not just dangerous for a few Americans, it's heartbreaking for the people. They're crushed. Violence everywhere. The kids can't go to school. And we're responsible. And there are other countries waiting in line if we don't act. Bush has 3 more years. You've got Iran there on the front line right now, the front burner, you might say. You've got North Korea, Sudan, Syria. He'd still like to pick off Cuba, but he'd love to take out Venezuela. But you can feel in South America, finally, the people standing up on their feet and recognizing what the United States is doing to them imperialistically and has for a couple of centuries. No election, no change in popular speech will be adequate to show the world that we really mean it, that the American people have risen up and done their duty as citizens of the world and citizens of their own country, and use the Constitution. It's a duty under the Constitution, which says the President, Vice President, other civil officers of the United States shall be impeached. Yeah. That's mandatory. And removed from office upon conviction. And we'll see what happens after the impeachment. But our burden is the impeachment. The sole power of impeachment is in the House of Representatives under the Constitution. And if we organize and if we mobilize and we make it the priority, if we focus on the Judiciary Committee, which will begin the task, we can make them honor the Constitution and do their duty in the House of Representatives and impeach the President. The history of politics and the Congress of the United States in my lifetime has been pitiful. I've been around this horn 3 or 4 times. The first important time was the effort to impeach William O. Douglas, one of the greatest justices to ever serve on the Supreme Court of the United States, a truly free spirit. And they wanted him off. And who filed the resolution of impeachment? I was sitting in the balcony. It was one of the lawyers for him, Gerald Ford, majority leader. 26 members of the House of Representatives to impeach William O. Douglas for what? For following the Constitution of the United States. We should never forget how Gerald Ford, a Yale law graduate, I always like to dig Yale, defined an impeachable offense. He's on the floor, he's introduced his resolution, made a long speech, and he says, "What then is an impeachable offense?" And he turns to answer himself and says, "To tell the truth," that always puts me off because you have to say what you've been telling me all the rest of the time. But it's just a habit that people shouldn't get into, to tell you the truth. He said, "To tell you the truth, an impeachable offense is whatever a majority of the House of Representatives says it is at a given moment in history," which means utter lawlessness, just the will of the majority of the House of Representatives. The words of the Constitution mean nothing. But what we have here is the supreme international crime by President Bush and his administration. The phrase supreme international crime is the phrase applied in the Nuremberg judgment on page 12 to the war of aggression. And that's what's been committed against Iraq and who next. If we don't act, as Marcus said, for the rest of the century, the fallout will be not only here, but all over the world. And frankly, as much as I love this country, I'm worried about all the poor people around and all the other continents. We have a duty to protect them, too, from our own aggressions, military and economic and social and cultural. We have to want them to have an opportunity in life where they live and as they are in their pure culture. But if we don't act to impeach President Bush now, the credibility of the people of the United States will be tarnished for a long, long time. And we can do it. It's a question of will. We have to organize. Each of us has to act as aggressively as we possibly can, exhaust ourselves in the effort. We've had an impeachment website up. It's now called impeachbush.org for 3 or 4 years. We've had a campaign vote to impeach on that website that now has more than 600,000 signatures. And when each signature comes in, it goes not only to her congressperson, the voter, to the chairman of judiciary, the speaker of the House, and to the White House to tell them what's coming. We have an obligation. Everything that America has ever said it was or wanted to be that was decent and good for children, to impeach George Bush and Dick Cheney and the principal officials who have carried out this criminal policy that has demeaned us and will take years of struggle to overcome.
You are listening to a forum on impeachment held last week in Washington, D.C., with Kevin Zeese, Marcus Raskin, Anne Wright, Ramsey Clark, David Swanson, and Cindy Sheehan. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, Free Radio Asheville, WZKW Kingsville, WRFN Nashville, KRBS Oroville, The Surge 96.3, RadioVeronica.us, WYQZ Warrenton-Bealeton, or WMRW Warren. We continue.
We're going to take questions now, and what we want from people are questions so we can have responses from the panel. First question.
Thank you. My name is Sean Bruins. I'm an Iraq war veteran. I think what bothers me the most about being a veteran is that, you know, a lot of us join up for the right reasons, for our First Amendment, to protect our First Amendment right to free speech. And here we are, you know, exercising that right in this room with you fine people. But, you know, it seems like nowadays, if you voice any dissent at all, they point their finger right at you and say, "You're anti-troop." It doesn't matter if you went and fought their illegal war for them like I had to do. So not only did they use the troops for that unjust war, now they use us, you know, for their political gain. Anytime you question anything they say, "You're anti-troop." I'm not anti-troop. I love the troops. I love America. I love this country. To me, that's the worst part of even looking at that picture up there of our president. And it hurts me to say that. But now I'll get to my question.